Hi, I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is the program where we talk about the economics of freedom here on WHUS Doors 91.7 FM. So thank you so much for tuning into my show this morning. We are going to be talking about student loans on the show today. Student loans have been getting out of control in terms of the prices that people are paying, in terms of the amount of time that people are indebted to the financial institutions after receiving their diploma. And we're actually broadcasting out of the University of Connecticut here in Storrs, and so I think this is a prescient issue for a lot of people out there. Now, this, like many other problems in society, did not just come out of nowhere. This is not the market. This is not the problem with education per se. But rather, we have seen that the government has been heavily intervening in this area of the economy for quite some time. All colleges are accredited, which is basically the same thing as licensure. We talked last week about licensure and how the medical industry is severely impacted detrimentally by licensure because it restricts the supply of the number of doctors available in the market. And this, of course, benefits them because they're a monopoly and they can charge, you know, whatever prices that they want. And no other competitor can enter into the market and try to bid people away. Another problem is that the government is the one who is subsidizing and loaning out all of this money, which when you subsidize anything, you get more of that. So we have more people jumping into the college education situation. And we also have the government putting up all these loans for people with seemingly no collateral. You don't need a house. You don't need any kind of credit check or anything like that. The government just says, oh yeah, here's 40, 50, 100K for you to go to school. Now, Bernie Sanders thinks that the solution is that we give everybody free college. And that's going to lead into a lot of problems. People are going to take majors that are not actually applicable to the workforce. They're going to study things like philosophy or things that are very interesting and in some cases are necessary in society. But in most cases, in terms of industry, in terms of actual practical application to a job set, not actually that useful. The other problem with any quote-unquote free product that is being offered is that prices and profit are cut out of this entire calculation process. People need prices to really understand how much to allocate where. Should we be putting more of our resources into college rather than industry, rather than people's houses, rather than cars? You know, there are so many other options that we could be spending money on. And when you get rid of prices, people tend not to calculate in terms of how much value they're going to get from a particular thing. So people tend to consume more of it. There's an overconsumption, and the supply is often not raised to meet this additional requirement of the customer. So roads are a good example of this. How often have you sat in traffic on a road? Well, that just means that there's a lack of supply of the road for the demand required of it by the customers. Now, any profit-seeking business would look at that and say, well, we can adjust our prices. We can maybe do peak pricing so that people who want to drive when there's the most amount of traffic would have to pay a higher rate. And maybe that would offset some people who would be able to work from home for a little while and avoid that kind of peak pricing. That would reduce the demand for the road at particular times and would increase the supply. Or maybe they'll just expand the road because they know that they can get more money from people who are willing to pay the price of the construction of those new roads. Now, of course, the government doesn't do any of this stuff because they have no idea and no inclination to increase the supply of roads to meet the demand. They get paid either way. And Mises pointed this out in his book, Bureaucracy, that any bureaucrat is going to get paid whether he does a good job or a bad job. And so you're going to see those same kind of problems persist when the government gives us quote-unquote free college. You're probably going to experience wait lists. People are going to have trouble getting into the colleges because we're not going to do anything about the supply. They're not increasing the supply of colleges available. And without prices and profits, there is no incentive to increase the supply of colleges. And so there's going to be wait lists. People are going to maybe have to take a back seat if they want to study something in the STEM fields, the science, technology, engineering, and medical fields. They might have to take a back seat for people who want to study, you know, liberal arts and philosophy and like some of these softer fields that colleges are offering. So let's talk a little bit about the problems, and then maybe we can get into some of the solutions of student loans as they currently are without turning to the government to provide this service for free. This article is called Barely Half of Student Loans Are Being Repaid. It's by Preston Cooper, and it's posted on the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE.org. The U.S. Department of Education's new data on the status of outstanding student loans show that outright defaults are up. However, their press release and much of the accompanying media coverage instead played up a decline in loan delinquencies. The increase in defaults is worrisome and needs to be addressed by Congress. The total amount of outstanding direct student loans stood at $855 billion at the beginning of first quarter 2016, distributed among over 30 million recipients. This total does not include loans still outstanding under the now discontinued FFEL program, which guaranteed private sector student loans. The total direct loan amount outstanding is up roughly 15% over a year ago, doubtlessly the result of relentless tuition increases. Excluding student loans owed by borrowers currently in school or in their six-month grace period, 46% of student loans are not currently being repaid. 10% of student loans are delinquent, meaning the borrower has missed payments for 30 days or more. Another 13% are in deferment, which means payments have been postponed for various reasons. Another 14% are in forbearance, meaning the borrower has encountered economic hardship and had their payments suspended or reduced. The remaining 8% are in default. 54% of loans are currently in repayment, up slightly from 51% at the same point in 2015. Now, these statistics do not mean that taxpayers will need to pick up the tab for 46% of the outstanding student loan balance, but they do raise a red flag that taxpayers could be on the hook for a lot of money if these loans are not repaid in full. Moreover, high delinquency and default rates will hurt the ability of students to gain access to credit in the future, slowing the economy. Unfortunately, the trend seems to be moving in the wrong direction. While delinquency rates dropped, overall loan non-performance increased. Most notably, student loans in default, defined here as loans more than 360 days delinquent, increased 31% in the past year to $56 billion. This far outpaced the 20% increase in the outstanding balance for all borrowers not in school or a grace period. Extreme non-performance of student loans is growing troublingly common. A strong predictor of student loan delinquency or default is whether the student has actually graduated from college, since students who drop out face limited employment prospects. Graduation rates at 60% have plenty of room for improvement. There are some other notable data points from the Education Department release. Parent PLUS loans, an effectively unlimited stream of funds for taxpayers to finance undergraduate degrees, are up 9% to $71 billion, well outpacing the 6% increase in regular Stafford loans. Recipients of Parent PLUS loans are up 6% to 3.5 million individuals, continuing a worrying trend that will likely result in ever higher tuition inflation. I've previously argued that the PLUS program should be eliminated before it gets too large. Total taxpayer exposure, including government guarantees of private loans, is up to $1.2 trillion. This is larger than outstanding auto loans, $1.1 trillion, and credit card debt, $0.7 trillion. The student loan balance is also growing faster than most other types of debt. Credit card debt has grown 4.3% over the previous year, while housing debt has grown just 0.1%. Of the major debt types, only auto debt grew quicker than student loans at a rate of 12%. That article was by Preston Cooper, called "Barely Half of Student Loans Are Being Repaid." The next article is by Ryan McNacken, and it's called "Don't Confuse the Cost of College with the Cost of an Education." This was posted on Mises.org, and we're going to be talking about how education got so expensive in the first place. For years, those who face the costs of educating themselves or their children hear a nearly incessant drumbeat of how expensive a college education is and how much debt they'll likely be taking on. On the other hand, we're told repeatedly that a college education is absolutely essential because people with a college degree allegedly make $1 million over a lifetime more than those who do not attend college. Most everyone agrees that tuition and fees are certainly increasing in terms of the price tag. There is far less agreement, however, on why the price of college education is going up so quickly. The answer lies in a mixture of government policy and the fact that colleges and universities today spend vast amounts of money on amenities and staff that has little to do with classroom instruction. Moreover, the tastes of many consumers of education have changed toward the more opulent and many aspects of the so-called college experience, which were virtually non-existent 30 or 40 years ago, are today considered to be necessities for college students. And finally, many students spend vast amounts of money on college degrees that will never contribute much to actually paying off loans or contributing much toward the graduates actually earning a living. Government subsidies enable price increases. One of the more basic observations of economists of all types is the fact that less of a good or service is demanded, the higher the price goes. This is why the demand curve is downward sloping and why fewer people want $10 hot dogs than will want $2 hot dogs, all else remaining equal. On the other hand, if the government gives out grants and loans for buying hot dogs, or if people are hoodwinked into believing they'll make a lot more money if they only eat more hot dogs, the price will rise quickly. There is no doubt that overall demand for a college education has increased based on the idea that a college education is the key to wealth. The broad conclusion that a college education greatly increases one's earning potential greatly over one's lifetime ignores the fact that not all college degrees are created equal. As the data shows, only certain college degrees are likely to bring back a good return on the investment. While economics and engineering majors are likely to pay off loans quickly and maintain employment over the long haul, people who spent six figures at a fancy university to get a degree of sociology of Latino studies are likely to struggle to pay off their debts. Moreover, if you're one of the people with a humanities degree, your electrician and your mechanic are often likely to make more money than you. And they gained that higher earning capability after spending far, far less in terms of time and money on their education. Once we begin to look at things on a case-by-case basis, the advantages of a college degree can melt away. So much of the increase in demand for a college education is based on a false premise, the idea that any college degree will get you a living wage. What you study remains very important. Nevertheless, going to college has for centuries been seen as a way to gain or maintain financial success, and the idea did not just enter the minds of the general population in the last 30 years when tuition prices began to skyrocket. What changed was the increased presence of student loans, and especially loans at low interest rates, thanks to government guarantees and loose monetary policy. Last year, University of Colorado law professor Paul Campos, who is hardly an advocate of laissez-faire, attacked the claim that direct government funding of colleges is being cut, while also noting the role of student loans in increasing costs of college. Quote, The conventional wisdom was reflected in a recent NPR series on the cost of college. So it's not that colleges are spending more money to educate students, Sandy Baum of the Urban Institute told NPR. It's that they have to get the money from someplace to replace their lost state funding, and that's from tuition and fees from students and families. In fact, public investment in higher education in America is vastly larger today, in inflation-adjusted dollars, than it was during the supposed golden age of public funding in the 1960s. Such spending has increased at a much faster rate than government spending in general. For example, the military's budget is about 1.8 times higher today than it was in 1960, while legislative proportions to higher education are more than 10 times higher. In other words, far from being caused by funding cuts, the astonishing rise in college tuition correlates closely with a huge increase in public subsidies for higher education. If, over the past three decades, car prices had gone up as fast as tuition, the average new car would cost more than $80,000. The data can only show a correlation, but basic economic theory shows us the causation. The government subsidies to students have lowered the perceived cost of attending college. This, in turn, allows a larger number of students to pay the ever-increasing tuition bills. Put another way, the inelasticity of demand for a college education has increased significantly thanks to the fact that students can now just go get a low-interest, unsecured student loan rather than having to save the money to use a high-interest private sector loan. Without these loans, students would be far more sensitive to increases in the costs of education, and colleges would have to find ways to cut costs in order to remain competitive in terms of pricing. With a nearly endless stream of government loans, however, colleges need never have to worry about cutting costs. Government subsidies will simply make up the difference, and price-sensitive students will go to college anyway. The downside comes later when the students must pay off large loans. Increases in cost don't go to classroom instruction. Campos also points to the fact that we can't blame the price increases on the cost of instruction going up. The amount of resources being devoted to actual classroom instruction, Campos notes, has changed little in terms of real dollars. What has changed is the cost of administration at colleges where, quote, a major factor driving increasing costs is the constant expansion of university administration. According to the Department of Education data, administrative positions at colleges and universities grew by 60% between 1993 and 2009, which Bloomberg reported was 10 times the rate of growth of tenured faculty positions. Even more strikingly, an analysis by a professor at California Polytechnic University Pomona found that, while the total number of full-time faculty members in the CSU system grew from 11,614 to 12,019 between 1975 and 2008, the total number of administrators grew from 3,800 to 12,183, a 221% increase. And administration is not the only place in which colleges are pouring money. Students are also paying for lavish amenities, such as recreation centers and luxurious dorms, where each room has its own bathroom, and much more. In their defense, college administrators have trotted out the usual old saw that budget cuts and not a country club living standard on campus is to blame for increasing tuition and fees for college students. But the immense increases in college fees that are necessary to support these new amenities would never be economically viable if it weren't for easy access to cheap student loans. Many people make purchases based on branding, not education quality. Another factor behind the rising costs for some students is the fact that students purchase costly programs not necessarily for the education they provide, but for the status of having attended a prestigious name-brand college. just as people will spend hundreds or thousands more on a handbag or automobile for the purposes of conspicuous consumption. Many students will do the same with their college educations, believing it will raise their social status. There is precious little evidence, however, that going to an elite school with a prestigious brand name will necessarily translate into higher earnings for students. Yet again, we find that what you study matters more than where you do it. So it is entirely plausible that the student who studies accounting at the thoroughly unglamorous public university known as IUPUI in Indianapolis is likely to earn more than a psychology major at some elite East Coast university. And of course, one makes a logical error by assuming that successful Harvard graduates were successful because of their attendance at an elite university. People who get into Harvard are already highly driven overachievers. Harvard students aren't slackers who are molded into elite intellectuals and workers due to the amazing quality of the instruction at Harvard. That's not how it works. This isn't to say there's something wrong with choosing to attend an elite college if the opportunity presents itself. Consumers make decisions based on a variety of subjective criteria, and it may be that for some of them, consuming the product known as Ivy League College is very important and well worth the additional cost. However, these people tell us little about the true cost of obtaining an education. Those who choose to attend costly elite colleges when opportunities exist for attending more modestly priced programs should be excluded from analyses that claim to tell us how expensive education has become for the average person. Many people are willing to pay extra for the college experience. Finally, it's important to note that much of what drives demand for colleges, especially among the middle and upper classes, is a desire to get the so-called college experience, which has nothing to do with the quality of instruction or one's future earning potential. In truth, living on campus as a college freshman and taking advantage of all the entertainment, lifestyle, and social amenities offered to live-in students is a luxury that is not essential to obtaining an education. Students who live off campus, of course, often report feeling left out or at a disadvantage in terms of finding the right social events. These things are not without value, and many students may conclude for themselves that the college experience is worth the extra cost. But let's not pretend that such experiences are essential to obtaining a college education. Moreover, simply attending a costly four-year college in one's freshman year is an unnecessary luxury overall, regardless of where one lives. As billionaire Mark Cuban, an Indiana University grad, correctly notes in this video, from a financial point of view, it makes far more sense to attend one's freshman and sophomore years at the least expensive college one can find, where college credits will transfer up to more costly four-year schools. These economic facts won't stop many students, however, from insisting that they absolutely must attend an expensive liberal arts college in order to get the full college experience. The cost of education versus the cost of college. As with any consumer's preference for attending an elite school, we cannot say that any particular student is wrong for attending a school that costs $25,000 in tuition per semester. It may be perfectly rational from the student's point of view to attend a college because it has pretty buildings or the students are good-looking. Being surrounded by beautiful people and beautiful buildings really is something of value. However, let's not pretend that those amenities are essential to the process of obtaining an education or increasing one's earning potential. In the background of every political discussion over higher education is the assumption that a college education is essential to combating poverty and other social ills. So if we're going to engage in an honest discussion of the true cost of education, we have to differentiate between what is being paid towards financial betterment and what is being paid by some people toward a 4 to 6 year vacation. What a free market in colleges might look like. Student loan subsidies have so distorted the market for higher education that we can't even tell the difference anymore. In a world of more market-oriented colleges, we'd be seeing colleges that work strenuously to reduce costs while increasing the quality of faculty instruction. Instead, what we find is a race to produce ever more luxurious amenities or funnel more and more money to six-figured salaried administrators and staff to run a high-end rec center for students. Colleges would likely focus on providing easy-to-attend classes for part-time workers, many of whom are low-income, who must attend college at the lowest cost possible. Students would focus on fulfilling basic requirements at lower-cost schools and community college while waiting to access the more costly lab facilities and other resources in the junior and senior years. Many low-income students already do these things, but in the absence of subsidized loans, the total numbers using these strategies would be far greater. Certainly, those with the means would still attend costly, luxurious schools, but most would recognize that those students are paying for something other than education. Far larger numbers of students, though, would attend colleges that specialize in delivering an education in a timely and cost-effective manner with few frills. The number of students attending amenity-laden schools would fall considerably, and many liberal arts colleges would go out of business. Urban and suburban campuses, while less sexy, would benefit instead as students turn toward more economically easy-to-access colleges that are more focused on job skills and integrating students into the larger community that includes employers and industries that need employees. As long as government student loans remain a dominant factor in the pricing of higher education, though, we'll continue to see more and more growth in the cost of higher education, which will continue to be a boon for the colleges themselves, while placing a heavy burden on students who don't understand how little of what they pay actually goes to education. That article was called "Don't Confuse the Cost of College with the Cost of an Education." That was by Ryan McMacken. It was posted on Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. So we talked today about the government intervening in the college and higher education sector of the economy and how that has led to extremely high prices in that area, which is really the same for when the government gets involved in any area. The stock market and the medical system come to mind immediately. And so we also talked about how the market can help to alleviate this problem by driving costs down and by decreasing the amount of prices that people are going to have to pay to consume these services. So I hope that you enjoyed this. This is a presentation of the Austrian Circle here on WHUS Stores 91.7. I hope that you have a great week. Take care.